Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro. And this week, my guest is the CTO of It's Borrowed, Joe Moreno. Joe, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for joining me on the show. This is going to be fun because we've had sort of a similar background and you've done some really cool stuff. And so you are the Chief Technology Officer of It's Borrowed. We'll get into that later. Mm-hmm. You're a graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy, a former U.S. Marine officer, and you worked for Apple for almost 9 years as generally a software engineer, right?
That is correct, yes, yeah. Software engineer.
Wow, I'm impressed. This is cool. So in background mode, we tend to get a little biographical because it's always fun to hear about how people got started in their career. And we were talking before the show about Apple IIs. I wanted to ask you, when you were in high school, before you were in the military academy, were you thinking about the military a lot or computers a lot or a little bit of both?
When I was in high school, I was considering the Air Force because I had a technical interest and they were high tech. And then I once saw, I think it was an ad for the Marines, and I asked my father, why would someone want to join the Marines? Because it's so hard. And he said, that's because people sometimes like a challenge. And that stuck in my mind. And then I had my Pearl Harbor moment. I can't say 9/11 because this was well before 9/11 when a TWA airliner was hijacked. I think it was on its way to Rome, and it was taken to Algiers and Beirut, and it was on the news for a couple nights in the mid-80s, and that really got my goat, and I slammed my fist down literally and said, I'm going to join the Marines and do something about this.
Were you using computers at that time?
Yeah, I had started, my computer interest started, I guess, in junior high school. I had two big hobbies in junior high school, lasers and holography, and then computing. And computing was becoming more and more popular. And the choice of computers back then was kind of limited. There was one place a few miles away that sold Apple IIs, but there was the local Radio Shack stores that had the computer centers that had the TRS-80s. So I ended up with a TRS-80 Model 1, started out with a cassette drive and 16K. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I remember 6K of RAM. My first Apple II had 4K of RAM before I could afford an upgrade.
Wow.
And it was Integer Basic only, remember that? And then you had to buy a AppleSoft card that you could plug in with that red switch on the back. Yeah. Those were the days. You're not the only guest. You're just one amongst almost all of my guests who grew up with Apple IIs. It's an amazing thing to discover that just about everybody I have on the show says, oh yeah, I grew up with Apple II. It changed my life.
Right. It had color, it had sound, it had lowercase. It was amazing.
Yes, it was. It was. It changed the computing landscape forever. So you told me about why you wanted to become a Marine. For those listeners who are not quite sure about this, you have to go to the Naval Academy to become a Marine, right?
Well, actually, I shipped off to boot camp when I was 18, Parris Island. And I didn't want to go to college. I wasn't the best student in high school. So I joined the Marines as a way to get out on my own. I come from a very close family, but I wanted to get out on my own, be my own man, so to say. So went to Parris Island. And after that, I got assigned as a computer programmer in the Marine Corps. And while I was there, an officer I worked for showed me that the Naval Academy was an option. And it can be difficult to get into the Naval Academy because of academics, and also you generally need, at a high school, a congressional nomination. Mm-hmm. And I was lucky because if you spend at least a year on active duty in the Navy or the Marine Corps, you'll almost automatically get a nomination to the Academy from the Secretary of the Navy.
Oh, that's good to know. Yeah. All you young people out there who are planning a career in the military, remember that.
Yeah, that's the way to do it. And generally, I think my class at the Naval Academy had about 24 prior enlisted Marines that were coming from what we call the fleet. They were already in the Marine Corps. And I think the Secretary of the Navy has about 80 annual nominations. So a lot of them just go unused each year. It's just a matter of applying.
Did becoming a pilot ever cross your mind? I'm just curious about that.
Wow,
it was on my mind.
High school. Yeah, I wanted to in high school until I learned that you needed perfect 20/20 vision.
Yeah, that's what happened to me.
Right. And surgery wasn't an option. Now that's an option. And I'm a private pilot now, so I can wear glasses as long as I can, you know, see 20/40. So, yeah, being a pilot, it was decades later when I finally took the dive to become a pilot.
When I was an Air Force officer, I took private pilot lessons at Eglin Air Force Base. And that is a very big military base with long runways and lots of military aircraft coming and going. I mean, you're in a little Cessna 150.
Right.
You're like a rabbit in the forest. You have to be very careful.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
My wife almost got run over by a T-38 and killed. I almost got run over by F-4s. Fortunately, the F-4s are very smoky. They have these jet engines that put out a lot of black smoke, and I saw them coming. Save me.
Wow.
So you were in the Marines for about 21 years or so.
So my total active duty time was about 11 years. I did 3.5 years enlisted. Then I was at the academy for 4 years. Then mm-hmm. I did 5 years as a payback. So that brings me up close to 9 years. And then I went to work for Apple, but I stayed in the reserves and I got called up several times. Uh-huh. And my last time, I was deployed to East Africa to do humanitarian missions, which was one of my best deployments. I mean, when in the 90s, I did deployments to the Persian Gulf, peacetime deployments, but the deployment to East Africa for humanitarian operations was, I found that very rewarding. And I ended up living in Nairobi, Kenya, and working out of the U.S. Embassy there. And the weather, I mean, I live in San Diego now, but the weather in Nairobi is even better than San Diego. It's a beautiful city.
Hard to believe. Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask you about your career in the Marines and logistics and supply, because I have a sneaking suspicion that had something to do with you getting the job at Apple.
You know what? So I got lucky that I got the job at Apple. I went to a career conference for military officers from service academies here in San Diego, and a class of 77 graduates saw that I had been a prior enlisted computer programmer. And as an officer, I worked in supply and logistics, but mm-hmm. it was actually the fact that I had actually coded production systems when I was in the Marine Corps, and they hired me right on the spot in the late 90s. But back then, their interviewing skills for software engineers were not as good. You have to remember back then, I joined in Apple in 98, and the year before, Steve Jobs had just come back, and the company was within 90 days of bankruptcy in 97.
I remember.
So when I told people in the late 90s I worked for Apple, literally I remember a woman telling me once saying, "Wow, are they still around? You don't hear them anymore." And it was just pure luck. I didn't know. I didn't use Macs in the recent years before working for Apple. And for my first 3.5 years at Apple, I was on Windows NT and Windows 2000 because Apple had bought Next for their Next Step operating system and Web Objects, and I was a Web Object software engineer. So I was working on Toshiba Tekra laptops doing my coding, and it wasn't until...
What language were you using?
Java. We just bridged Web Objects. So instead of using Objective-C, it started using Java. And so I came up to speed on Java in the late 90s and the whole object-oriented paradigm, because before that, you know, languages were more procedural. And it worked out very well. But it wasn't until I got my first hands-on OS X. Actually, technically, it was OS X Server around 99 when I understood what Unix was and how powerful it was. And now I realize almost every computer runs either on Windows or some type of Unix, like Linux or OS X mm-hmm. or Solaris or something. And I can see why that, even though Unix has been around since the late 60s, why it's so powerful. It's got some big advantages over Windows, but I might be biased.
I know the scientific community got very excited around that time when there was glimmerings of the public beta of Mac OS X. I remember mm-hmm. demoing it at a computer show, and the professor said, no, they don't run Unix. And I said, well, this one does. Apple's going right. Unix. And he says, I don't believe you. And I went over to the, I think it was the Power Mac G4 or something like that. And I opened up a terminal window and I said, here, knock yourself out.
Right.
He couldn't believe it.
And it's pure, it's real Unix. And they used to release Darwin, right? So Darwin is the core of OS X. When you turn the computer on, before you see anything other than the Apple logo and the gray screen, that's all considered Darwin. And you could download it before 2005 and run it on a Windows machine, not a Windows machine, but an Intel processor, which just fascinated me. It wasn't until 2005 when all of OS X came over to Intel.
But there were some elements of Darwin that were held back that were proprietary. I remember the communications protocol of streaming. They switched away from sockets and went to, what was it, some sort of communications protocol that was different than BSD sockets, and that was held back too.
Oh, so I wasn't aware of those details, but yeah. I know there were a couple things that, you know, they just kept their secret sauce.
I always got the feeling that Apple had a interest in seasoned technical people who maybe served in the military, who could keep classified information secret so they could keep Apple secrets secret. I was with a group in federal sales that was along those lines, and I think they appreciated that. So do you think Apple hired you not only because of your programming experience, but because your military background and demeanor and sort of leadership skills?
Yes. At the time, I would say that was the case because I was working out of the federal office for Apple when I first started in Reston, Virginia, consulting. Yes. That was, I think, their federal office there. And I was... At the time, Apple had something called Apple Enterprise Services in the late 90s that around 2000 got rebranded as iConsulting under a bigger iServices division. And my biggest project was with the military Sealift Command.
Oh, did you know Bob Femiani?
I don't recognize
that name. He was the federal sales guy in my era for Navy.
The big guy there, I think, was Dave Sabata.
He was my boss's boss.
Yes.
I'm surprised we never met.
Wow. Wait, maybe we did. We might have met in that Reston office.
Yeah.
Realize it.
Because I used to hang around in that Reston office quite a bit.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Interesting. Interesting. So you've been away from Apple now for a while.
About 10 years.
Yep. Yeah. Same here. I wanted to ask you, do you feel like it's kind of like the same company that you knew when you worked there, or do you kind of feel like, wow, they changed?
I feel like the DNA is still there, right? Even more so now because they're so big, but just they are so big. Every few months, I go up to Cupertino and I give speaking engagements on what makes Apple different when it comes to what's their philosophy, what makes them different when it comes to marketing and branding. And when I go over to the campus, it's just huge. When I say the campus, I mean Infinite Loop, the old campus that was built in the early 90s. And they have valet parking there now because there just aren't enough parking spots. They have to like double stack it. But I feel like the core DNA has always been there and it's still there, which is basically, you know, best possible customer experience. And I think Steve Jobs was very good at achieving that through products. That's all he cared about, I think. Whereas now with Tim Cook, it's more about best possible customer experience through by empowering employees.
Services, infrastructure.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes. So.
Well, I want to talk to you some more about this, but right now we have to take a break.
Okay.
Folks, we'll be right back. Stay with us. We'll be back in 60 seconds.
Hello there, all you fabulous background mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
And we're back on chatting with the CTO of It's Borrowed, Joe Moreno. So as soon as I saw your resume and I saw the things that you were doing at Apple behind the scenes in the online store and so on, I got really interested in, because I'm betting you have some interesting stories to tell. You wrote an article called Former Apple Engineer Reveals What's Going On Behind the Scenes When the Store's Down. You know, we sort of roll with it. We do the newsy thing on our end, you know, on the morning of the keynote, the store goes down, we announce it. We have little knowledge, really, about the screwing behind the scenes because there's going to be a new product announced. Right. But you don't know what they're going to be either, right?
So that's exactly right. So we would turn the store
How frantic
off.
Is that?
You know what? It actually would go well.
Really?
We would turn the store off, and then Steve Jobs, when I was there, Steve Jobs was CEO, he would walk on stage, and he would announce all the new products that we had no clue about because there was a product marketing team that put them into a secret database. And while the store was down, we would copy the secret database to the live database. And then he would walk off.
Could you see what it was, or was it blinded somehow?
Yeah. No, it was just data, right? Because the way we don't have access to the database. So we wouldn't see it till the store came back up. So Steve Jobs would walk off stage. We'd bring the store back up, and it would come up under a huge load because everyone would skip the marketing pages and goes to the store. Right. And this is when Apple used to have its own dedicated store. About 2 years ago, they sort of integrated the store into the product pages.
What did you think of that? We had some second thoughts about that when it happened. How do you feel about that?
Well, my thought is initially it brought a tear to my eye, but it's simpler. Why do I need to leave the marketing page to go to a store? Why not just be able to put it straight into my cart from the marketing page and then just have a shopping cart that is pretty much the entire store? And if you think about it, at Apple we used to say innovation is anything that reduces the cost of a transaction in terms of time or money.
Reduces the friction, so to speak.
Right. Yes, reduces friction, right? So that's real innovation. It's something that's overall reduces the amount of steps you need to go through. So then rather than going from the marketing page to the store and then putting it into your cart, why not just put an item straight into your cart from the store?
Did you ever have a time when you had trouble bringing the store back up for some technical reason and you were panicking?
While I was there, that never happened. And just to be clear, the part I was responsible for wasn't bringing the store up or down, but my code was for caching items. Before I got there, we used to, every time someone would look at products on the Apple Store website, the store software, the App Store, would go to the database and pull all these items back, which is kind of a waste because databases have this overhead that's called ACID that makes them durable. And ACID is atomic, durable, independent, and consistent, which is a lot of overhead when you're just reading. So rather than read from the database, we would just cache all those items in memory, which is done now, you know, at every company. It's not a big deal. But the week after a Steve Jobs keynote, we would do a postmortem, and we would see where we CPU constrained, disk I/O constrained, memory constrained, or network bandwidth constrained, and then we would scale that up the next time.
You worked on load balancing, I think. I saw your blog where you talked about that.
So we didn't. That blog post, we didn't load test the entire website, and I was kind of fascinated when I started working at the store. What we would do is there's something called unit testing where you just test like a method in code. We would do component testing where we would write a certain amount of functionality, and then we might hit it with a million requests, and we would statistically look at how long the request took to come back, and at the end of our sprints, when we would demo our work to our managers, we would say, hey, this caching algorithm that we're using 94% of the requests came back within 10 milliseconds, 97% came back within 20 milliseconds, and no request took longer than 50 milliseconds, and that would be deemed, say, acceptable. And that's how we would, you know how far the store could scale based on how many users or customers we were getting at any given time.
How does that mesh with the experiences I've had, at least in the TMO team? You get up at 1 in the morning Denver time, which is midnight California time. You're trying to buy the iPhone 6S that you want, or 7. Right. And you're starting to tear your hair out, and you're thinking, well, do I need to go to the store on my iPad directly? Is it better to use Safari browser? Why can't I get the memory that I want? And you sit there and you click and you wonder, is this going to work? And it seems like there's 5 million people trying to buy a phone all right at once, and it just never seems to go according to plan.
So something interesting with the phones is there's a step in there, or there used to be, where the Apple store would have to make a call to, say, AT&T or Verizon to verify your billing information or verify mm-hmm. the phone number. And that has been a bottleneck. I think when the iPhone 4 came out, that was a huge issue. Everyone would get to that step, and then AT&T couldn't manage the load.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
Yeah. Right. And that's – I mean, we used to scale our software so we could handle 10 times the load that we would expect. So we want our processors on all the systems running at single-digit CPU utilization. So if we see that CPU utilization starting to go up, I mean, when you start getting about 70, 80%, you know, people are going to start noticing lag and systems will start failing. It'll just become an avalanche.
Do you use a rollover system where if one server can't handle the request, it rolls gracefully over to another one and another one and another one?
When I was there, it wasn't quite that graceful, so we just managed to keep the servers up and running, mainly because the technology we're using, WebObjects, was a lot of times it was session-based, meaning the request from a person's web browser had to go back to the same app server if they had a session with something in their cart to recover all that. If they're doing something different now, and I'm sure they are, I don't know the details of how that would work.
Interesting. Interesting. It's always an exciting time trying to buy an iPhone every September.
Yes.
I wish that Apple would do a global rolling window so that as your window opened up, you know, you could order instead of people worldwide having to get up at 4 in the morning, East Coast, and, you know, and people at some odd time in Tokyo. You know, if you just had your own 1/24th of the globe rolling window, it'd be cool, but maybe that would give priority to some people first. I don't know, but I always wish that there was some better way to do it instead of opening it all at once.
No, I know exactly what you're saying. I mean, that's what I did when the first iWatch, you could order it at midnight. I think it was the first week in April, if I recall correctly, 2 years ago. And I think I had my iPad, my iPhone, and the computer opened all at the store.
Yeah, as we do.
Yes, a little redundancy on my end, too. Yeah. Sometimes one channel gets in better than another, which I've seen. I don't remember the specifics. I remember if you go to the app on the Apple Store, you'd be able to order something that you couldn't get through on the website because the entire world was on the web.
It used to be the secret trick was to use the app on your iPad or your iPhone because it seemed to have a better path into the Apple system. But this last year, as I recall, in September 2016, Safari worked better for me than the App Store app. So it's statistics, I guess.
Don't know how. Yeah, I don't know. But yeah, I just try all of them.
That's right. That's right. So we got to move on. I wanted to ask you about life after Apple. You worked for a series of small companies. Was that more leveraging your expertise in software engineering and databases, or was it more logistics?
No, that was actually, I took my software engineering experience from Apple, and I had a couple startups, and one of them was a URL shortener that allowed you to attach advertisements to it. And this was at the time Twitter was, I wouldn't even say it was becoming popular. This was 2008, so Twitter was still very new. And at that time, if you had a long URL, a long link that you put in a tweet, it would take up the same number of characters as the tweet was. So a 50-character URL would take up 50 characters in your tweet, and you only have 140. So my URL shortener quickly got pulled in the direction of Twitter as a way to shorten URLs, and then also as a way to track the number of clicks specifically by IP address. So I could see exactly who had clicked on a link by their IP address.
Did it survive?
No, I launched it. There were just a few of us full-time employees. We launched right after, a month after Bitly launched. But here's the amazing part. The entire company was literally launched with one tweet. And I didn't realize what had happened. We launched on a Tuesday, and I sent a press release to Guy Kawasaki, who used to be the first software evangelist under Steve Jobs at for the Macintosh. And I sent him the press release on a Tuesday, and Wednesday, it was around 4:30 in the afternoon, I'm looking at the web server logs, and they just start going crazy. I thought it was some sort of denial of service attack. So I started digging down into the logs, and I saw that the referrer was this tweet that Guy had sent out, which he hadn't told me that he had sent out. And then at 5 p.m., all the traffic just stopped, and I thought that was my 15 minutes of fame, so to say. But what would happen is at 5 p.m. on that day, it was a Wednesday, that's the time of the week when the server logs rolled over. It's technically midnight GMT. So once I got the new logs up and running or scrolling, I saw that all the traffic was still there. So I reached out to Guy, and we became fast friends because he would say, I need the ability to send a tweet at a later point of time. So we'd code that up for him. He goes, I need the ability to repeat a tweet every 4 hours because noon here in California might be, you know, the middle of the night in Japan, and I want people to see it.
That's right.
And yeah, and then Twitter started something that you couldn't repeat tweets. So we came up with some different ways to do it. And even years later, the solution we had come up with, Guy mentioned to me that we still use that idea you come up with, which is very simple. We would send out a tweet. Let's say we send it at noon and we want to resend it at 4 p.m. So 4 p.m. rolls around. We would actually go to Twitter and tell them to delete that noon tweet. And then verbatim, we'd send out that tweet at 4 p.m. And at 4 p.m., when a tweet's sent out, even though it's a repeat tweet, the early one has been deleted, so it's not there in their history. So it goes out at 4 p.m. So that was a nice little hack.
Cute. So did BitLY sort of take over?
Yeah. Bitly, they took funding. We had some revenues early on, but they weren't enough to help us grow. So Bitly had taken funding. And then when I was working with Guy, since Guy is more marketing, he referred me to another coder, Dave Weiner. And Dave Weiner is best known for co-inventing the RSS feed format and the podcast feed format. So he referred me to Dave, and Dave's an avid blogger, so he blogged about this experience where he went in and he looked at how I was shortening URLs, and he didn't like it at first until he understood that I was taking static web pages and sticking them on Amazon S3. So when you clicked on a link, rather than going into a database, looking up what that link should be and then redirecting you, it would just load a static HTML page with a meta refresh that would immediately redirect you to the destination. And what Dave Weiner loved about that is it was simpler in that it didn't require a database for support. And Amazon S3 rarely goes down. So you know that link is going to be around forever and good. Most of those links from back then still work, but they take you to destination web pages that are 404s nowadays because the actual content is no longer around.
Right. So we're about running out of time, not quite. I want to make sure we have time to jump forward to your latest endeavor. Yes. You're the Chief Technology Officer of itsborrowed.com.
Yes.
Tell me about that, how it got launched, and what it's all about.
So it launched, about a year ago. The CEO was traveling, and he wanted to play golf, and the local golf course didn't rent out shoes. But he knew within a mile of the golf course there was someone who had shoes with the same size. So he said, wouldn't it be great as part of the sharing economy like Uber and Lyft and Airbnb if there was a way for people to share or lend out products that are in their garage just gathering dust? So he outsourced the original development, and what ItsBorrowed does is it allows people to take photos of things in their garage, golf clubs, camping equipment, surfboard, and make money by lending it out to people in their community. Or if you live in, say, an apartment and you need a ladder and you don't have room for it, you can go on the app and find who in the neighborhood has a ladder that you can borrow. And if it's, say, you're borrowing something for $10 a day, we take 20%. We take 10% from the renter and 10% from the owner. So if you list something for $10, we're going to charge the renter $11, and we're going to pay the owner $9. So we've launched it here in San Diego, and we're narrowing down the market segment that would be ideal, whether it's bike rentals or surfboards or golf clubs or power tools. So
I could see how that could run into some complexities in both in the database and whether an item is already checked out and whether it's not available anymore.
Right.
And some of those logistics issues that you've dealt with in the past. Does that all that come into play based on your experience? I say that's a perfect marriage because you have the technical experience in software engineering and web objects and also in supply in the military.
Right.
To sort of bring that all together.
Right. But one of the... So we're considering using a third-party service to make the deliveries, but for now, you could say we've outsourced the logistics and the storage to the users, both the owners and the renters, because much like Craigslist, they use the in-app chat to arrange where to rendezvous. You know, what time,
that was my
place.
Next question. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. But we would like to do that as a next step, right? It could be anything, DoorDash or Uber delivery. To make deliveries, because that's becoming amazingly popular. I just heard about Amazon Flex, which is like Uber for Amazon. Instead of delivering people, you're delivering packages. So like an Uber driver, you sign up, you download the app, you go to the warehouse, you scan the products, they go into your car, and then the app tells you the route to drive to optimize delivery. And all you do is drop things off if they're packages. If it's something like a food or groceries, usually you'll meet the person face-to-face, and there's some sort of tip that you'll get through the app, much like Lyft. After a ride with Lyft, you can tip the driver.
How do you handle the occasional security issue where somebody puts something up for loan with evil purposes? You ever
right.
had any problem?
So we have a couple limitations. There's certain items you can't list. We're still not allowing anyone to list items over $500 just to keep them simple. But we monitor what's listed, and right now that scales okay. So we can see the items that are on the app. And if there's a problem, we can just make the item inactive. So,
what about insurance if the renter doesn't return the item?
So that's going to be our next step. There's a company called Peerby in Europe that does something similar, except they don't charge for the renters. They don't charge for the rentals. They only charge for insurance. We don't yet have insurance, but we do have the renter's credit card. So much like Uber, if a person gets sick in your car, Uber will find them, say, $200, $300.
Yeah.
You'll get that money to detail your car because, you know, once someone gets sick in your car, your night is over as an Uber driver.
Right. Yeah. Right. Well, we're starting to really run out of time now. It's been a cool story. Is there anything you want to add that I didn't ask you about? Anything? Any last words?
You know what? One last word is a question I get a lot is people ask me, did you know Steve Jobs? And the short answer is no, right? He wouldn't know who I am. I've spoken to him once. But if you went to Cafe Max every day when I worked there and Steve Jobs was there, about once or twice a week you would see Steve Jobs come in. and he would sit down and eat, usually with a software engineer or a product manager. And a couple times I actually sat one table away, and I was surprised because here I was seeing a completely different Steve Jobs than the public was used to seeing, where publicly he gets on stage, he tells you why this is the greatest thing. He was very good at always leading with a product's benefits, not like most engineers that lead with features. But when I saw him sitting at lunch at Cafe Max, he was so quiet. He would sit with the engineer and he would simply ask a question like, how can we integrate this app and this app?
Oh,
and then he would just be quiet and he would just soak in whatever the engineer was saying. And you could see the gears spinning. I had no idea what he was thinking about, but it's very, very interesting to see that side of him where he's very quiet and just asks a really short question and then just listens.
Great story. Thank you for that. Yes. A CEO has to listen and absorb and integrate. Cool.
Yes.
Well, so this can bring us to the end of the show. I want to thank you for this great story and telling us about your career and what you're doing now. Thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure, John. I appreciate the invite. Thank you.
Tell the listeners how they can contact you if they wish.
If you want to contact me, simply joemoreno.com, joemoreno.com. My phone number is there. My email address is there. My CV and bunch of articles, just a one pager there with all the information to contact me. I appreciate that.
Cool. Okay. And listeners, I'm glad you came by and I hope you enjoyed the show. Thank you for being a Background Mode listeners. We'll see you next week.